Welcome again to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And again, it is not a matter of absolute accident that this is Milt Rosenberg speaking. And I should make clear that we're recording this conversation on Friday, June 20. Why is that important? Because so much has been happening, and a few things will happen between now and the time you hear this conversation, which I trust will be only in 2, 3, or at the most 4 days after we have recorded it. I'm once again joined by two members of our old A team. They are Charles Lipson, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, one of the leading members of his discipline, and Chris Roebling, who is a conservative political activist, has been for many years. He also works in corporate PR. Indeed, he has recently founded his own new firm, ClearSpan Strategic, LLC. He's been a congressional staffer and very frequently and very often a performer on radio and television. These days on radio, particularly with us, but had his own radio and television programs and continues in that line of pursuit. Gentlemen, you remember the old tune, one of the good oldies. I forget what its title was, but the refrain is, what a day this has been, what a rare mood I'm in. It's almost like being in love.
It's almost like being in love.
Thank you, Charles Lipson. I've got an adaptation of that.
Yeah.
What a week this has been. As I say, this is Friday, June 20th. What a week this has been. What a rare mood I'm in. It's almost like being, you finish it. For me, it's almost like being depressed or unhinged or confounded. It's been really.
It's almost like being Groundhog's Day.
Groundhog's Day.
We're just seeing.
Same thing every day.
We're seeing bad news every day. And the shocking thing to me, Milt, really, is that there's a scandal on Monday, and it's knocked off the headlines by Wednesday with a new scandal about something else or manifest incompetence. So the VA scandal.
Oh, we've forgotten that already.
You know, the VA scandal seems like years ago, but it's not. It's really still ongoing. Iraq is already in front of us.
I've got another thing I want to quote you. Here are a number of titles of recent columns from as listed by Real Clear Politics. Just the titles, maybe the authors as well. Oust Maliki to save Iraq, David Ignatius, Washington Post. Media dropped the F-bomb, a failed president, Howard Kurtz. A media critic for Fox News now. President Obama is the new W, Lloyd Green in the Daily Beast. IRS scandal and the high price of Obama fatigue, Henninger in the Wall Street Journal. The poll is bad for Obama, but worse for liberalism, Phil Klein, D.C. Examiner. That may be a touch on the wishful side. A cautious Obama misreads history, Ruth Marcus, Washington Post. A unified theory of Hillary Clinton, Peter Beinart, The National Journal. Is Hillary Clinton imploding? Jonathan Last, Weekly Standard. Yeah. Immigration reform can't wait. And the author of this one is Rupert Murdoch, Wall Street Journal. There's a lot there to pick on. Your first response to that list?
I would say chickens and confluence. The chickens of five and a half years of President Obama.
Are these chickens that have come home to roost?
Yeah, and the confluence of events is extraordinary this week. And one thinks of August 1914 and Barbara Tuchman.
My goodness.
And now I'm thinking of June 2014 and what we are seeing in the Middle East, because I think that has to be the overwhelmingly the single most significant development, and that is the fact that we have this sea change on the terrorist side from operating sub rosa in any number of jurisdictions to actually trying to establish their own jurisdiction.
That leads me to yet another quotation I've prepared. Then I'll stop with all these quotations. This is very relevant to what you've been talking about. George Will recently wrote, given the absence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and given that we now know how little we know about, quote, nation building and about the promotion of democracy in nations that need to be built, and given that Saddam Hussein's horrific tyranny at least controlled Iraq's sectarian furies, and given that Iraq under him was Iran's adversary, and given that 10-year wars make Americans indiscriminately averse to military undertakings, given all this, If you could rewind history to March 2003, would you favor invading Iraq? And, of course, Will favored invading Iraq in 2003. And he's now saying, I was wrong, and it has been a great disaster.
I think most people who supported the invasion thought that there were weapons of mass destruction, and support for the invasion evaporated, including from people like me, when we found out that the main danger that we were trying to avoid was not real. We had really been assured of that. But there is a second point in what Will is making that's very important. The kinds of projects that the United States got into in places like Afghanistan really require long, hard slogs. And this country is not comfortable with those long, hard slogs, and for good reason. They're expensive in both blood and treasure. But in the case of Iraq, don't blame the people. This one was won. This was defeat snatched out of the jaws of victory. And what's happening
by the withdrawal of American troops?
By the total withdrawal.
Yeah,
the military wanted to leave 23,000 people in there. Obama made them an insulting offer of 3,000. They would have been left supporting only their own protection.
Did the Maliki government
turn them down?
Did the Maliki government also request that we keep the 25 or so thousand?
You know, I don't know what their request was. They were being pushed hard by Iran to pull out all of our troops. And what's going to happen, Mel, the big point here, is that what you're seeing now is another Iran-Iraq war of a certain form with one additional bad feature, and that is that the terrorists will have a base and they can attack us.
Okay, I agree about the terrorist base. I think, and probably we agree, I don't know, but maybe that's why we're here to chat about this, chat this thing through. If the oil refinery 100 miles northwest of Baghdad is actually out of the control of the so-called government of what we once called Iraq.
We had that news 2 days ago, in fact.
Right. But I don't know when this thing is
forth.
On the radio.
Yeah.
It's back and forth.
But
exactly.
That ISIS has taken command and control of that oil.
But it's gone back and forth.
But it has gone back and forth. So it's a focal point. And I believe it is not just a focal point. It's a fulcrum. It is a fulcrum because if that is out of whatever we once called Iraq, then I believe the Kurds have a green light from the Turks to declare independence. And if the Kurds declare independence, then we are in a new version of what once was Iran-Iraq, because we're really in a Sunni-Shia situation where the Shias there are a lot of wrinkles in this, but basically the Shias in what once was Iraq will be supported by Iran.
That's correct.
And the Sunnis in what once was Iraq are going to be supported by the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so we are on the precipice, I believe. This is why I say June 2014. We're on the precipice of an unseen conflict in the Middle East since World War I.
Now, it may be that we are on the precipice of or on the verge of a final reorganization which undoes some of the mistakes by the conquering powers after World War I. That's when they set That's when they set up the modern Middle East. And there are those who are saying that was never Iraq was always a kind of an invention.
Yeah, correct. Bell and Winston Churchill.
Right. And the ultimate outcome necessarily has to be a reversion to not a single costly unified Iraq, but rather three nations where one was, namely a Shiite East, a Sunni West, and a Kurdistan North.
Right. I mean, so partitioning Iraq, enunciated once by Joe Biden, it might turn out, and I'm saying this very loosely and not technically, may have been actually the secret policy of the Obama administration.
I doubt it.
I doubt it, too. But it is interesting that that Biden said that, and now this is happening. And I think this is all apart from the point that Charles made, with which I agree. I think that we had ballast in the bottom of the boat with the remaining U.S. troops, a couple of divisions, who could have both done some search and destroy. They could have protected Baghdad. They would have disincentivized a lot of adventurism by terrorists inside what we used to call Iraq. And when Obama failed, and when Hillary Clinton failed to get a status of forces agreements, and when they were coming out, that ballast came out, and we're now reaping.
They failed in one other important way, Milton. When Maliki came in after about a six-month or some long period like that of trying to form a government. He and another and a more secularist faction had roughly tied. This was a case where the United States could have weighed in and helped a secularist government take power. And, in fact, we backed away and did nothing. So we got a bad guy who has ultimately turned the Iraqi government into a Shia militia, and then wouldn't, and then when Obama gave him a lowball offer, refused to take it. Who backs him? Iran. And now you've got what you've got. But it does not stay within Iran. Iraq.
We have the suggestion from some in Washington in the government that maybe what we've got to do is league with Iran in the buoying up the Maliki government. Iran are one of our great
adversaries
impossible.
Now becomes a possible partner.
Well, I mean, I think that's
and has thereby a signal to go forward as rapidly as possible in building their nuclear weapons.
Well, I think that's an instance of fantastical thinking by those people in Washington.
Yeah.
And I do give Hillary Clinton credit that she said, absolutely not.
Yeah, right.
Whereas John Kerry is sort of open to the idea. But we have to understand, and I think I don't know that I've said this here, but, Valerie Jarrett has been negotiating privately with Iran. And that has been established that she had a secret meeting in Oman with representatives of Tehran. And that indicates to me that there is interest at the Michelle Obama level in some kind of legacy claim that relates to an evolved relationship between the United States and Iran. And that is just a datum on a big screen that shows a tilt from the Sunni side of the Arab world to the Shia side by the United States under Obama.
Is it by the United? Well, it's by the United States, but as you say, under Obama. Are we looking at essentially Obama foreign policy now fully revealed? And I turned to my colleague from the University of Chicago. I am emeritus. He's still a full-time professor political science, Charles Lipson. And I do that for this reason. There's yet another figure in the history of political analysis as performed at the University of Chicago, a fellow named Rashid Khalidi, who ran the Middle East Studies Center, was a not totally infrequent guest on our radio program here, now runs the big Middle East Studies Center at Columbia University, and was a rather close friend and associate of Barack Obama. And Khalidi is a Palestinian advocate by his background and by his actual family connections, and is one of their leading intellectual figures. Certainly anti-Israel, certainly in general, part of the Arab hardline intellectual formation. Are we looking at a Rashid Khalidi Middle East policy as transmitted and transmuted by the President of the United States?
I think that imputes too much coherence to the Obama policy.
Oh, yes?
My sense is that, yes, you're right. It's the faculty lounge, left liberal foreign policy with all the competence that you would expect.
With a touch of anti-Israeli commitment.
Oh, deeply so. And they made huge mistakes at the very beginning of the Obama presidency when they, for example, demanded that Israel stop building settlements. I should say that I favor stopping building in the further out regions, not around Jerusalem, but in the further out regions. But the Palestinians themselves had never demanded that as a precursor to any negotiations. When the administration said that, they kicked back. Palestinians couldn't have a weaker position than Washington, so that stopped everything for over a year. But it also kicked everything off on the wrong foot. I mean, it just told you. And of course, then when the administration comes to the Israelis and says, oh, we reassure you that we've got your back on Iran, of course, the Israelis don't believe them, don't believe It would be hard to believe any other country would do would have their, any other administration, but they certainly don't believe Obama. They don't trust him for a minute. But the bigger problem, Milt, is that Obama came in with a foreign policy strategy, which was an outreached hand of friendship to all of our traditional enemies. So the reset button with Russia, for example.
A great statement of all of that Cairo speech by Obama.
And the Cairo speech. You're absolutely right to underscore that. What happened to all of that was that it failed. It failed in the same way that something like the Affordable Care Act is failing. But what, instead of acknowledging failure and setting a new strategy, what's happened has been flailing around with no strategy at all. So when that's why they're left trying to choose between Iran and Al-Qaeda in Iraq. This is the result of having no policy for years. And the same in Russia and Ukraine. They just have no policy.
As there's a lot there to chew on, let's hear some mastication from Chris Roebling.
Well, I think that Charles is generally right. I think that when the Obama administration took office, there was a political impetus to not be George Bush.
And there was a Nobel Prize for being not George Bush.
I was going to say they were rewarded for not being George Bush very early on with a Nobel Peace Prize for no visible efforts towards peace. So but that obscured the fundamental national imperative of distilling out of the Bush record, the Bush-Cheney record, as odious as those terms might be. You would distill out that which is significant for the defense and of the U.S. and the advancement of its interests, and that which was failed and failing. Okay, they didn't do that. They just said if it took place under Bush-Cheney, then it is wrong. And they had this – they conceived of a tabula rasa. They conceived of a blank slate. And then they decided to write upon the blank slate these, I think, kind of gauzy nostrums from the campaign, i.e. we'll have an outstretched hand of friendship. And that evolved into the speech at the Cairo University. And unfortunately, that speech was not a strong enough basis for any kind of effective defense of America or advancement of our interests.
Chris, I agree with so much you said. And in fact, I want to take it one step further. Right. I think this idea that you raised about tabula rasa, the kind of blank slate, is something that the most ambitious versions of liberalism think. When they think about social policy and political policy in general.
Right.
I think that's what happened with health care.
Right.
I think it's the opposite of Burke, where you build and make small adjustments.
Right.
And I must say, it's a feature of American conservatism that it also now is very ambitious and wants, because the incrustation of bureaucracies and these policies ever since FDR, I think the right really wants to roll a lot of that back. But in Obama's case, this tabula rasa, but start from scratch, is a generic problem.
Yeah, I think that this is my professor Thomas McTighe of the philosophy of history used to have this phrase. This is where historicism descends into historicity, and which is a nice turn of phrase. That's why he was a professor. Anyway, the point here being that there is, I think, on that side of political theory or political philosophy or practice, a sense of the ever widening new tomorrow, that everything can be different tomorrow. That we're going to create this.
You can sing, Milt. Tomorrow.
Right. Tomorrow. And this is why the Clintons had Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow as their theme song, because they didn't ever want to be impeded by today, let alone the outreach of yesterday.
Now, let me remind you, and again, making reference to the date of this recording, which is June 20th. It was, I think, June 18th, the night of that the president. Or was it the 19th? Was it only last night? I don't remember anymore. of course, things have been flowing so rapidly. But the president has announced our response to the crisis in Iraq, and it's
right.
to send some 300 military to do advising and training still again. You get echoes of Vietnam from a long time ago?
No, because we can't go back in. The problem Let
me finish on this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me finish on this. Let's examine what we had in the presidential response. Remember, he was surrounded by all the military and defense advisors. We've got a response to the crisis. Is it a meaningful response? Can it possibly alter the outcome in the great struggle between ISIS, so-called, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the struggle between them, and you quite rightly identify that as an al-Qaeda force, and the Maliki government, with the Kurds looking on apprehensively but also ambitiously from the north? Can anything be altered by the Obama response?
Very little. Step one is, I think there's enough there to reinforce our guard at the embassy.
Yeah.
So folks who are at the embassy are a little bit better off, and yet they're getting out of there as quickly as we can say it. And number two is the small groups can go out and coordinate drone strikes or even, attack aircraft strikes.
He didn't say whether they would be doing that.
No, he didn't. But they can do that.
ISIS swims in the sea of the people, to borrow something from Mao Zedong. They're in there, and you can't just hit them without hitting a lot of innocent collateral.
And you'll be
persons.
On the. And ISIS also has the backing of the Saudis and a number of the other
sure.
Sunni groups. So we would, in effect, be the air force for Iran. This has big strategic implications for the region.
Huge, huge. But can I hit this point of the 60s for a quick second?
Sure.
From a friend of mine, I don't want to use his name because I think he's still but this is a friend of mine who has spent a career at the Foreign Service, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I heard echoes of the political language of the 1960s. Of the political 60s in the current leaders when they are either trying to exploit this foreign policy imbroglio or avoid accusations of, quote, losing Iraq, unquote. The statements that the U.S. will only send, quote, advisors and that the fate of the country rests in the hands of the Iraqis are channeling, quote, unquote, Kennedy. We all know how those few advisors in Saigon, now ironically called Ho Chi Minh City, were augmented and how Diem wound up at the business end of a gun. The parallels are frightening. An artificial country carved out of a former European colony that degenerates into a civil war with at least one side espousing an ideology considered a threat to U.S. interests. Where is Santayana when we need him?
Santayana, for the famous quotation, those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it.
You know, I'm always amazed when I come in to talk with you, Milt. We have had historicity, imbroglio, Santayana quoted. And
he's a good man, Santayana.
And Thomas McTighe.
And, I'm just a country boy here, and I'm amazed at what you guys are talking about. So let me tell you why I think it won't go the way of Vietnam.
Right.
The reason it won't go the way of Vietnam is because of Vietnam,
right.
And also because of the experience in Iraq.
It's the basic phenomenon of war weariness.
Absolutely.
Will mentions in that paragraph I read to you.
That's exactly right.
We can't send 100,000 or 300,000 troops back into Iraq. We're not going to.
No, there won't be. There could be mission creep. I think that your friend is right. But I should add that we don't know that these soldiers who are going to be there have any protection from Iraqi law. That was part of the sticking points why we didn't get a status of forces agreement. Well, what are these guys coming in with?
But if the policy maker, in this case the president and the secretary of defense and the secretary of state, but ultimately the president, the policy maker is confronted with the question of what to do today. And I think one of the defining realities of what to do today is how our choices are limited by what we did yesterday. And we are in...
That's a fundamentally Burkean point, and it's right.
Sure. We are confronted on all sides by it because you're absolutely right. If if there are folks in the administration who say we've got to deploy drones, we've got to deploy attack aircraft, we've got to get in there and disrupt the logistical supply lines of ISIS, if there are people who say that, there is no doubt in my mind, Charles, that you're absolutely right. That is going to escalate this crisis in a heartbeat.
Does ISIS, which is an offspring of al-Qaeda, clearly, and is drawing lots and lots of young Sunni men to the battlefield. It seems to be a movement in Iraq coming down from Syria, which really has excited the aggrieved Sunnis of Iraq, and they're armed and they're ready to go. Does it, in a way, ISIS and the ideology behind it, which is Salafism, is Wahhabism, is that whole trend in extremist religious ideology.
Yeah, let's behead the bad guy, yeah.
Yeah, extremist Muslim ideology or theology, actually. Does it represent, in a way, a wave of the future in the modern Middle East?
It may be a wave of the military future.
Yeah.
But one thing that we've learned about these Islamic regimes is that they can't actually govern their countries. They can't deliver. They can draw on the fundamentalist anger that a lot of people have. But you saw...
And that fundamentalist anger, you would agree, has risen and risen and risen in the Middle East.
It has, but there has been pushback depending on the country. I mean, we've got to remember what happened in Egypt, which is a good example of the Obama administration.
Right.
I think the Obama administration's true answer to what to do in Iraq was his first answer. We need to think about this. I think that that's his general approach. He's not fundamentally a manager and decision maker.
Well, let's come to that. Let's come to the reevaluation of Obama, which is also being heavily indulged by the American press and by all sorts of partisan people in American politics. He had recent poll data, which was dismal. A New York Times.
It was at Wall Street Journal and NBC News.
That's the one. And lowest ratings all the way across the board.
Right.
We now have columnists asking, is
his
the new W?
Over?
I read that title.
Right. Is his presidency over? Chuck Todd, NBC News.
All of that. What's going on?
Well, I think you have this. I'll quote Professor Lipson in his recently, nationally.
Wise man you are.
Nationally distributed column from the Chicago Tribune to papers all over the country, and that is these discrete points of information about President Obama are beginning to accumulate into a discernible pattern. And I believe, and let Professor speak for himself, I believe the pattern is beginning to be one of incompetence and one of inability relative to management of simple governmental tasks or the chosen tasks of the Obama administration.
Incompetence, or an alternative interpretation, might be a willful march forward against a fair amount of opposition and against a fair amount of generated confusion, or march forward to reorganize America in a direction which was foreseen a long time ago by some of the people upon whom Obama drew when he was being politically socialized, so to speak.
You're both right. You don't choose between them. And in fact, the fact that his goals are so ambitious, social democracy goals, sort of an America that looks a lot more like Europe, which is what you're saying, Milton.
It is what I'm saying.
It demands extremely competent execution of government policy, which is lacking, which is what Chris is saying. So I think it would be virtually impossible to manage that anyway. It's very hard, and it drags down growth, and it has a lot of other problems with it. But I think that you're both right, and you should think about the way that the two intersect. So controlling immigration is a core function of every government. The fact that we are not able to do that, that the president has sent signals without even knowing he was sending signals, in the same way he drew the red line in Syria about chemical weapons without thinking. He just said it. So he said, you know, we're not going to throw out young children. Well, they hear that in other countries. They start coming here, and then he has to go back and say, hey, I was kidding. We're not going to let
you say
that's
a dysfunctional consequence of something he said perhaps too hastily. However, the alternative that could be offered is no. That is the expected consequence because the general policy on the part of the Democratic Party or those who strategize for the Democrats is let's encourage as much immigration as we can. That Latino vote coming north will, in fact, give us a permanent hold on political power in the United States for the Democratic Party. I think of the situation right now with all those kids from Central America as well as from Mexico crossing the border. I think that what you got there is a border which has gone from merely permeable to now emitting a great sucking noise as the vacuum in the north sucks up
possibly in a desired way.
Reference to Ross Perot.
I'm going to use a word on this conversation that I've been waiting to hear at the national level. Do you know that the number of kids we now have down there on the border, we are approaching Mariel Boatlift numbers? I mean,
the Mariel Boatlift was
an extraordinary sequence of events in approximately 1979, where there were some economic reversals in Cuba and some folks tromped into the Ecuadorian embassy, if memory serves. And within about 5 days, there were 10,000 people on the grounds of the embassy of either Ecuador or Peru. And Castro was confronted by the closest thing he's ever had to a domestic revolt.
And he said, let them go.
Now, he had done things like that about, 15 years earlier in the early 60s with teachers and educated folks and things like that. But he said, let these people go. And so he opened up his prisons. He opened up some of his hospitals.
The Carter administration
didn't know how to handle this, and they started putting them into abandoned army bases. And this started at the end of April, if memory serves, 1980 or 79. And the first full month was May of 79 or 80. And I believe, if memory serves, there were 65,000 people who turned up in the United States. We have now got about 60,000 kids down there on
that
border.
And as soon as that happened, Castro decided, let's open up all of our prisons and send those people to America.
And so we sorted through that. That was a total...
In what period of time have those kids come up across the border?
Well, they started, I think, towards the first of the year.
Yeah.
So there was a trickle. And then with these presidential statements to which you refer, it spiked. And we are
only over the last month.
Over the last 4 weeks. And so
the trickle had been on the order of 6,000 a year. And now we're moving into this 60 to 120,000 a year unless they do something to stop this. And they're transiting Mexico. These are not Mexicans who live near the border. These are people coming all the way from Central America.
And this implicates all kinds of things, not the least of which is the inability of the federal government, as Charles was just saying, to execute one of the undeniable responsibilities of the federal government, which is to control the border.
Let me simply throw you a few other tag words and get your response, because we're talking about the Obama government, and it's been challenged by and it's been criticized for various other things that have been popping in the news in the last few weeks, as well as over the longer haul of the administration. So, one term. You may remember hearing this. It's a coinage, Obamacare. What's happening?
Well, I think the internals of Obamacare are collapsing, but it is ignored, as is the immigration crisis by the mainstream media. And by that, I mean we are rapidly reaching the point at which the additional folks who have been given access, and God bless the fact that everybody can have access to the healthcare system when that existed a year ago, and et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have any more doctors. And the hospitals are themselves tending to reduce in number. That's not to say that all beds are down, but beds are, generally speaking, down. And so we are headed to the precondition necessary for vast, I mean Soviet era levels of shortages, which turns into allocation by government. In other words, we're going to have rationing.
But I think that the problem that they ran into at the VA really blocks them from what they would love to do, which is move to a single payer. I've been talking with, because single payer is sort of the VA for everybody, but the problem is we lavish money on the VA and they still don't get it done, but we wouldn't be able to lavish that on the whole American population. So what I hear
advocates from, of a single payer argue that, yes, we can do it for the whole population. That's what our cousins in Canada have done, and it's worked rather well up there, they say.
Well, it's possible that it works well in other countries, but inevitably what you end up having to do is ration care and especially expensive care. So if you need a heart operation, an open heart surgery like my wife did when they did a CAT scan after months of having problems. They were trying to save money. Don't do a CAT scan. They finally do a CAT scan. They find that she has an aneurysm, and they give her that information at 6 p.m., and she is in an open-heart surgery by 11 p.m. In Canada, she'd be in an open-heart surgery, you know, months later, and in some places she would have never gotten the CAT scan. And one of the problems that you end up with is very expensive care. Somebody's got to decide, is this person with Alzheimer's who needs a liver transplant going to get the liver transplant? And inevitably we're going to say, no, we just don't have enough money
the
for that if we're in a single-payer system.
The specter of death panels, as they call
yes.
it.
Yes.
Well, the VA is very instructive because over the last 10 years we've had there's a variegated picture, but generally speaking, we've gone from 25 and a half million down to about 21 million veterans who have access to or rights for the system. And in that same period, we've gone from funding of about $55 billion to $145 billion. So we have increased funding significantly for a decrease in the population. Now, you can say there are differences in the afflictions that are visited upon the veteran population. That's absolutely
true. Baby boomers from Vietnam who are getting old, and we have a lot of injuries from the Middle East that would have led to deaths earlier that
Correct.
Have come back with
and
serious
now,
injuries.
And now they require intensive care. Yeah. But the fact here is that Obamacare, first of all, let us not forget the obvious, and let's just state the obvious. There is nothing like the Obamacare that was passed by Congress or then upheld by that initial Supreme Court decision that has been implemented. It's nothing.
They're just playing it by ear as they go along.
35 extra legal changes in Obamacare, right. which itself proves that Obamacare, as passed, was unenforceable.
You say extra legal changes. There are some viewing the current administration, who argue that, by golly, impeachment might even be undertaken. It wouldn't pass through the Senate, but this president is, through executive order, is violating the constitutional limits upon his power. Do you agree that?
I think there's a lot.
Can a case be made?
Yes, there is a lot of that, but I think impeachment would be just a disastrous mistake for the Republicans unless the president is absolutely and directly implicated in something like a felony, like the IRS targeting directly.
Right.
But because what we've learned about this, there is still a lot of personal support. The president's election was a historic moment. This is the first African-American who's ever been elected president, and there's a residual concern, regardless of what race the president is, this partisanship has gone too far. So I think this would be a drastic mistake unless there is a genuine felony that's uncovered.
I wanted to throw out one or two other verbal tags for your quick response, and time is growing rather short. The next verbal tag, quite simply, three letters, IRS.
Yeah, IRS indicates the absolute worst dimension, the worst characteristics of the Obama administration, because And here again, the mainstream media has done nothing to...
Or maybe the worst characteristics of embedded bureaucracy in any large governmental system.
Yeah, but I think it's both. I mean, I think there's a big story at IRS and at VA about union domination. But in either case, there has to be some kind of signal at the top of the pyramid, the organizational pyramid. IRS is a place where... one has to be very deeply concerned about constitutional rights and about the respect for constitutional rights by our federal government, because they are obviously actively obstructing the investigations into what happened at IRS with the what we are specifically referring to. What I'm referring to is the destruction of records and the destruction of the electronic means of storing those records.
This, what Chris says, is absolutely right. The IRS scandal is a major scandal on the order of Iran-Contra and maybe approaching Watergate. When the 2 years of Lois Lerner's emails were missing, and it turns out those of six other people who had been targeting conservative organizations, the major news outlets, NBC, didn't mention it ever on its evening news. ABC didn't mention it ever on its evening news. CBS did mention it, but I don't think PBS has mentioned it either. What you're seeing here is a kind of head in the sand news coverage that has now come back to bite them. 10-15 years ago, people wouldn't have had alternative ways of finding out the news.
Right.
Now they do. And so when NBC or PBS or ABC or the New York Times or the Washington Post doesn't tell them, they know that it's a hide-the-ball game. And that's exactly what's happening.
I wanted to have a third member of our panel, namely Katie Kurth, who was with us last time.
Right.
And representing certainly democratic liberal orientation. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't manageable just in terms of time schedules. Therefore, I ask you, play a role of democratic strategist and apologist or defender. What would the democratic liberal member of this panel, if we had one today, be saying in response to what you two have been saying?
Well, what I hear from Democrats is disappointment. They are admitting to disappointment. They admit that they had unreasonably high expectations and that Obama neither lived up to the unreasonably high expectations nor to normally or reasonable high expectations. They are disappointed. They, however, shy back from... in much as the mainstream media has shied back from, NBC didn't even report on its evening news its own poll, the results of the poll.
Oh, I'm shocked. Really? The NBC Wall Street Journal poll?
They did not.
Results were so bad they didn't like them enough that they wouldn't even tell the people?
I think people may draw own conclusions, but that is exactly how the Democrats
know. Well, surely after a day or two they got around to talking about it.
It has not been on the nightly news.
Really?
It has not been on Brian Williams' program. Maybe last night I didn't check. But in any case, people are saying they're admitting to disappointment, they're admitting to unreasonable expectations, but they're shying away from any kind of colligatory concept.
Oh, and they think that Obamacare is working.
Yeah.
That is the fact that you don't hear scandals day to day. I mean, I was at lunch the other day with a strong Obama backer, and he was saying, boy, you know, what do you say now, Lipson, about the fact that Obamacare is just doing so great? And I said, it's not. And I said, I gave him, you know, the kind of responses that we've given earlier, and he was just not buying it. I think that'll all come back into the news when the premia go up in October and November, and when some of the other kinds of failures happen. But I just think that what you're seeing is, you know how there are some people, Milt, you know, who get divorced, and they talk about how bad their first spouse was, but most people just say it's unmentionable. And I think you're seeing more and more Democrats say it's unmentionable. And let me say something about elected political officials. The problem with the Wall Street Journal NBC poll for Democrat office holders is the following. It means you have to run 10 points ahead of the president in order to be elected to anything.
Right.
That means you have to distance yourself from the president on almost everything.
Chris made mention earlier of going from history to historicity. I'm not sure what this is.
Historicism.
Historicism to historicity. What is historicity?
Well, historicity is a disconnection with prior events, essentially. It's technically a school within the speculative philosophy of history.
What I'm musing about at this moment, and the moment is with only about 5 minutes left for our deliberations, is how in this discussion, inevitably, the whole broad history of our present era and the recent events, which involve many, many other people, many people of all kinds of power distributed through all kinds of nations, but how almost all of our conversation devolves upon a man, one man, in one office in Washington, D.C. We've made this essentially an Obama portion of American history, or maybe of world history, rather than referred to broader forces grinding forward as inevitably in a Marxist or Marxoid view they do.
He personifies this era. He personifies this moment. And he
more than Bush personified his moment?
I think as Roosevelt
personified his moment?
I think as much as Roosevelt. But the point that I want to drive home here is that Obama has served as a front for, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but he fronts for a spectrum of thought and a spectrum of activity. And all of those thoughts, all of that activity have been channeled into his administration. And I think now this is 2014, June, as you say, 20th, and we are seeing, we are reaping that
The spectrum of thought to which you refer, how does one label it? What is the nature of that line of thought?
I would say it is post-national statist progressivism.
Uh-huh.
I think that's pretty accurate. I would
post-national statist progressivism.
Let me give you a slightly different take on it and a more American-centric view. I think that there's a long arc that starts with the New Deal programs that goes through FDR and culminates in the health care program. You saw it when you saw John Dingell sitting there beside President Obama. He's been fighting for this and then, for his whole billion-year career. He inherited it from his father, and his wife's going to inherit it. This is like the Ottoman Empire. But the fact is there's this large arc. A key moment was when President Roosevelt threatened to pack the court. The court backed down from previously calling most of his initiatives unconstitutional because they violated constitutional prohibitions. It said, basically, do whatever you want. That then, the next big step was LBJ's Great Society, the war on poverty. But when you see the death toll on the south side of Chicago, the unemployment numbers of poor African Americans and the like, people, which is the same arc of policies that Obama's pursued, people are beginning to ask, beyond the more conservative market-oriented precincts, is this kind of big government, which is emblematic of the Democratic platform, is this really going to work in a practical way? They're not asking it ideologically. They're asking it in a practical way. What was shocking about the Obama presidency is that when things started to fail early on, unlike Clinton, who pivoted back toward the center as soon as Newt Gingrich won control of the House in 94, Obama has just marched on. He's the little Energizer bunny that just keeps going and going and never turns direction.
He's quite resolute. I mean, I agree with Charles. I think that Obama has never yielded, and I think that the time, just as in the first year of
Reagan. Is he sustained by a clear and strong vision which motivates him, or is he essentially rigidified because he's doing what he's done in the past and he's advocating what he advocated in the past, and that's all he knows to do?
I believe that his the truest words he ever spoke were those on Grant Park the night he was elected, about yes. fundamentally transforming America. And I believe that is a window to his soul. I believe he has stuck to that. I believe he's never deviated from that. I was going to say, in the first year of Reagan, we had that moment of truth with PATCO, and subsequently we saw others like Grenada.
With the strike of the air controllers.
The strike of the air traffic mm-hmm. controllers, and the fact that Reagan said, this is wrong, they're not allowed to do this, and we're
and
not going to back down.
Thatcher did the same thing.
Thatcher did it with coal miners, Arthur Scargill.
With the coal miners and with the Falklands.
Yeah.
She just showed some backbone.
That's right. And Obama showed backbone in 2009. He came back after all of the Tea Party protests about health care, and he went to Congress and he said, we are going to stick with this program.
I'm looking for a final literary reference to close things out. And what comes to my mind, literally, free associatively at this moment, is that strange piece which was a biography of, or rather a character portrait of, Henry Luce, written for the New Yorker many, many years ago, I think by Wolcott Gibbs. And the trick was to write it in loose language, which inverted
yes.
the location of verbs and so on. The last line of that long profile of Henry Luce was, where it will all end knows God. And with that, we got to a necessary close, with warm thanks to our two very, very special friends, namely Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson.